I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I often have guests on this program that lament the state of journalism nowadays. Usually they're veterans of the business who say it ain't what it used to be. While I like waxing nostalgic here, there are some terrific young journalists in this town doing remarkable work. Justin McElroy is one of them, and he joins me now. I'm not going to burden my guest with some of the terrific things people have told me about him, but people within the field of journalism in this town have had a lot of nice things to say about him. He is a writer and a web producer over at Global BC. His keen interest in getting the news right and history make him an ideal guest to talk to. He was coordinating editor for the UBC, where he is a graduate. He's worked for NBC as well as Maclean's and the province. I'll get him to tell us about his work over at Global, as well as his views on journalism and media consumption. We'll also get into the current federal election campaign, as well as the happenings over at UBC, where a change in senior leadership occurred over the summer. JustinMcElroy.com is his own website's address. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, Justin McElroy. Mr. McElroy, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in to do this. It's a wet day outside. I haven't been outside yet today.
It's a Vancouver day.
Did you find, because you work over at Global, and I see your tweets, and I see your posts on social media, you must hear from people who watch the broadcast there.
Oh, yes.
And, I mean, are they really as preoccupied with the weather as we're led to believe?
Oh, yes, is what it comes down to. At Global, one of my first jobs there was doing, among other things, picking up the phones during the time that News Hour was on. And so you have everyone, predominantly older viewers, who have an opinion about the news, but don't have the internet, they would phone up and ask questions. And I can't tell you the number of them were about the weather, why we didn't talk enough about it, what's going to happen next week. In their area, there was this. Did you know that? And I would go, okay, it hailed in Maple Ridge an hour ago. That's cool. But then you look online as well, and we have access to who reads our stuff online, which is both great and terrifying sometimes. Yeah. And it is weather stories. It's the storms. It's the fires. It's the once-a-year blizzards. It's the type of thing that really does unite us all. It can be a little ironic because, of course, in Vancouver, we have probably the mildest weather of anyone in Canada outside of Victoria. But it's one of those things where you realize, yeah, people care, and you laugh a little bit, and then you go, all right, well, let's report this as best we can.
So having worked there, you've been there now, what, 2-3 years?
3 years. Now.
3 years. Yeah. Because it's the news leader in this market, in this province, you have a sense of the people who rely on it, the viewers. Mm-hmm. They do care about the news, don't they?
Yeah, no, they're tremendously passionate, and, the 50-plus years of history that we have with so many of them, places in the interior where BCTV at the time was all they could get, and, they care about the stories, they care about the personalities. When we do something that they like, they let us know. When we do something they think is wrong, they let us know. And it's great to get that feedback every day because you realize, you can read the comments online and you can read the snarky stuff from people about where the media is going. But when you do hear that feedback every day from, an appreciative audience, it reminds you of the responsibility we all have as journalists, and particularly we have at Global News to get the story.
I guess the federal election, that's something that we're all thinking about.
Yep.
I always wonder when the media talks about it, whether the people in the real world say if they actually care about it.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of it, say, a month before the vote?
I think now people are starting to get into it. You see more quote-unquote regular people to talk about it. I see more of my friends who aren't politically inclined ask me questions, for this first month of a record 2.5-month-long campaign, because it was so far away and in the summertime, I think it was something of more interest to journalists because most of us love elections. There's something innately fun about them. But I think we are starting to get the point where it does matter, and when you have three parties this close in the polls, which is almost without precedent in Canada outside of the 1988 election, I suppose, you are going to get everyone who's politically engaged actively engaged.
You've done great work on your own website as well as on the global website, looking at writings in British Columbia that we ought to watch, that we ought to pay attention to. You mentioned it's a three-party race in this province especially. That's not all the ridings, though, right? I mean, like in this riding that we're sitting in today, Vancouver Kingsway, is it really a three-way race, do you think?
No, and in a lot of the province, it's straight NDP conservative races.
Yeah.
If you look at historically, there are many places where the Liberal Party has struggled to break 20%, not necessarily here, but especially in the interior, in Vancouver Island. They've long been flip-flop between the NDP and the Conservative. It's always annoying when I have to write it out because I have to say Conservative / PC / Reform / Alliance.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yes, it breaks down overall as a three-way race, but there's only about two or three ridings in British Columbia proper, you know, Surrey Newden, Surrey Centre, Vancouver Granville, maybe West Vancouver, maybe North Vancouver, that really you can say at this point, yeah, all three of the main parties have a real shot of taking that seat.
And sort of the shoe-ins, I guess, would be, well, I guess Elizabeth May, is she a shoe-in in her riding?
You would think so. I mean, people there tend to like her. She does get a lot of positive feedback for her work as an MP, advocating for constituents and being open there. And, you know, people on southern Vancouver Island have really taken to the Green Party, electing Andrew Weaver, and they finished second in a number of provincial elections and by-elections. That being said, there's no precedent for re-electing a Green Party MP, so we don't quite know how that takes out, but no one is betting for her yet to lose that one, I will say that. But you do have blowouts, you know, in northeast BC, the Peace County. Everyone expects the Conservative to get at least 60% of the vote, like they always have. Same for the NDP in northwest BC, Skeena Bulkley Valley with Nathan Cullen. And, you know, some of your seats in the Fraser Valley, your Abbotsfords and your Langley Alder Groves, it's hard to conceive there of the Conservatives not getting the same amount of votes that they get every election there, regardless of whether they win or lose.
I'm assuming you'll be working election night?
I will. It's I love election nights. They're great fun. So we're figuring out exactly what I'm going to be doing there, whether it's helping for the online side or the broadcast side. But it's going to be fun. And, you know, for television, elections are great because, it's still a place where everyone goes to for their information. And, B, it's our job to guide people through the ups and downs and what when the different results come in, why it matters, and create some sort of narrative to make it make more sense than just 338 writing results being thrown at you. So we're figuring out the best way to tell that story and be prepared and have a lot of different ways to explain it if certain things happen, and I'm looking forward to it.
What will you be watching for on election night?
I'll be looking for... I mean, one of the exciting things now is with the way that the laws change, you can actually see the results in Atlantic Canada and report on it without having it be a criminal offense.
So it's like 4:30 our time, I
guess? It's 4:30 our time, so we got 2.5 hours to really savor those 32 seats. So I'm going to be looking at a few of those that are considered swing ridings and the way that they break, how much it goes to one party, and have clues that way. And then... you know, there I have a list of about 15-20 seats, a few in Montreal, a few in Toronto and Scarborough and Mississauga, a couple in Saskatoon and Calgary and Edmonton, that I think will really decide the election at the end of the day, if it stays the three-way race that we see. And that'll give a good sense of exactly how things will break down when the final province, the polls close, and that's British Columbia. And it'll be fun to have, you know, possibly the fate of the election hinge on Mission Matsqui Fraser Canyon.
Yeah, and I guess the day after, a couple of days after, then you guys can all trot out the constitutional experts, I'm sure.
Yes. And, you know, we were back in that position in 2004 and 2006 and 8, yeah. But it could be much different this time around if, you know, the sea projections that everyone is saying right now hold true.
Another story that's in the news in this part of the world that you've been covering over at Global, and if we follow you on Twitter and the sort, you're quite interested in, and that's what's going on at UBC.
Yeah, it's hilarious for me, simply because I was an editor at the UBC newspaper for 4 years, and so I have all this background and knowledge of how this $2 billion university, that for the most part the public doesn't care about, works, and the inner bureaucracy and the machinations and how decisions are made and sort of the strengths and failings of them as a governing institution. And you assume that will rarely matter again, because mainstream media, for a lot of valid reasons, isn't all that interested in the inner workings of UBC. But then you have a story like this, and it's about something, specifically the Board of Governors and University Leadership and Administration, that I really took an interest to when I was an undergraduate. And now I get to apply that and try and explain it to people who suddenly care. And it's been weird, but it's been a lot of fun.
So we as a media consumer, as a citizen, say, of British Columbia, we should care about what's going on there.
Oh, I certainly think so. The thing that I always say is, you know, when you look at the amount of money it gets from the provincial government each year, $580 million or so, no strings attached, in addition to all the different grants and one-time funding and capital projects, it gets taxpayer support equivalent to, you know, your ICBCs and BC ferries. And it has a level of influence in terms of our long-term economy, our how we integrate international students and immigrants into the province, in terms of what we're trying to do industry-wise and research-wise going forward. It's tremendously important. And yet, for the most part, it does fall by the wayside. So any excuse I have to sort of remind people of all that when they're partly interested in UBC, I'll happily take.
Yeah, like transit as well. I mean, the future plans of transit and that whole referendum that we had not too long ago, I mean, was a lot of those proposals were incumbent on getting to UBC.
Yeah, and as someone who took the B line for many, many years, I can certainly sympathize with what UBC was hoping for and what UBC students were hoping for. Of course, one of the weird quirks is that UBC itself isn't a city, it isn't a municipality, it's not part of Metro Vancouver, and so it wasn't really fully part of these plans, and so it had difficulty really communicating and being part of this push from the other Metro Vancouver mayors. I'm not sure, given how poorly the referendum results went for the yes side, UBC being more active there would have made any difference, but it's interesting to contemplate.
You produced the segment that, the interview, I should say, that Chris Galis did with Martha Piper?
Yeah, well, I helped, I field produced it, essentially, yeah. Putting it together and then helping with the questions, but, you know, ultimately it's Chris making the final calls on those things.
So, having observed it as a producer over at Global and then in your previous incarnation as an editor over at the UBC paper, what are your observations as to the leadership and how UBC is led in terms of communication to the public and us getting to know what's really going on? They've done a pretty bad job, but then at the same time, aren't most institutions like that?
Well, and it's difficult because when you're so used to the public generally not caring and your main communication having to be to faculty, to staff, to the Board of Governors, to students, in a very specialized sort of way and not to the mass public. Not to say that their communication on this front to those groups was particularly good either, but when you're used to that being your modus operandi, and then suddenly you are in the middle of a crisis situation, that can be a very difficult thing for any large organization to turn their communication strategy around on a dime. And I would imagine, you know, the people who work in the communications department at UBC, I know a number of them, and they're all very smart people. And sometimes in their situations you feel bad because they know they have one way that they would like to do things, but oftentimes it's people higher up who are used to operating without as much transparency, wanting things to go a certain way. And then you have, you know, these PR people who used to be journalists who do understand and value the idea of openness and transparency, having to follow those sort of orders.
As a journalist, what questions have you got still about, say, Dr. Gupta's resignation, his leave-taking, and where UBC goes from here?
I like everyone else, I'd like to know exactly why. I'd like to hear from members of the Board of Governors as to, look, we made this monumental decision a year ago. We entrusted this guy with the keys, and just one year in, we've decided that it's no longer worth it, that we're willing to basically pay the $1 million, basically, in severance and a new presidential search and so forth to wipe the slate clean, and we're willing to have, essentially, a three-year pause on any big strategic plans or going forward because of all these openings that are filled by interim people. I'd like to know. Those are big costs, and they must feel justified for the reasons why it made sense, and I'd like to know why.
Do you think Dr. Bergdahl, who raised a number of her concerns in a blog post, brought up race? Do you think that's a factor that's worth? I'm not asking if you think it's a factor in all of this, but do you think it's a factor? An aspect, I should say, of this whole drama that ought to be discussed.
I think generally things like that should be discussed. I think when it's, you know, very quickly brought up as a possible explanation with no real research done into it at the time, it's really hard to sift through, and it makes the conversation both more heated and less analytical, which are things that generally I don't care for I debate things. It is fascinating to think about those dynamics, and, you know, large organizations around the world are transitioning in ways big and small from leadership done from old boy style to ones that are more inclusive. I'm not sure how much that played a factor at UBC from the people that I've talked to. Who generally I trust with knowledge on these things, they've indicated that it wasn't a factor, that she was, you know, off in the way that she characterized it, especially because the previous president, Stephen Toop, was not exactly the most mock show of leaders either, and he got along with the board just fine. But, you know, John Montalbano, UBC chair's response to this, and the Board of Governors' subsequent way of addressing it, shall we say, has made it something that the public now will be thinking about going forward, and I think, you know, that can't be a bad thing.
And it's opened up discussions on gender, I've already mentioned race.
And that's, you know, what universities are about. Yeah. And I'm sure the university administration, if they had their druthers, would prefer that such open discussions about those things were happening on something not related to the direct performance of them, but here we are.
Well, when it comes to journalism, and having listened to you now for a few minutes, and then listened to another podcast, and read your work, and as I said, your tweets, you are someone who's quite passionate about journalism. So I'm curious to know why journalism for you.
Oh, I mean, part of it was I stumbled into it. I always loved reading newspapers and being up on current events. When I was in high school and in my first couple of years of university, but didn't think that could be a job. And then I, you know, went into the UBC newspapers basement office and realized, hey, wait a second, maybe this could be a thing, and got very excited. And part of it is, I think, you know, given the state, I always say this, given the state of the industry right now, if you're in it and you want to be in it, in spite of all the obvious challenges, then you should be optimistic and you should be really passionate about doing it. Because if you're not, and yet you still have a job here, it means that you're skilled. And if you're skilled and you can write, there's plenty of other places where you can do that without being overly pessimistic all the time.
But did people, say, older people in your life, did they think that it was a crazy idea to go into this business that so many of us have heard is declining?
Well, the funny thing is, when I sort of decided I wanted to try it, it was in early 2008, so right before the cliff of newspapers started collapsing. But I remember when I was in my last couple of years at the UBC, and I had some family members that would say, you know, are you sure about this? You hear all these things about newspapers dying, and a couple, you know, in their minds, helpfully saying, you know, I know a couple people who work in communications at this bank, and there's an opening for you there, and them not understanding why my face became suddenly quite foul. But I think there are always times where industries that you want to go into, there's not necessarily a lot of jobs available. There's not a whole lot of security. I consider myself fortunate that I am in a position where I do have a job and it is stable. But it's the type of situation overall where I tend to feel that if you love what you do, everyone always says, do what you love, do it with passion, do it a lot, and the rest works out. And for myself, and, you know, 95% of people in my cohort that follow that when it came to journalism, they're doing pretty well. And so that's why I don't lose hope, I don't lose despair, and I don't second guess.
What I admire about you, and we've only met today, but
although we've talked on Twitter.
We have, yeah, many times. Is that you don't view it as a job, per se. I mean, it's work, right? Mm-hmm. But so it can be a job most days, or some days. At the end of the day, from my observation, is that you want to make journalism better. And you know, in your own job, and outside of your job, yeah, in this city. I mean, that's a fair observation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think because it's something that is out in the open. Everything that we do as journalists, our finished product, is there not just for one client to see, but for everyone. And they can praise it, they can criticize it, they can brush it over, they can nitpick it. And, you know, if you know that going in, and you care about your work like everyone else, I think you do. There is virtue in being able to go home at 5 o'clock and shut it off, and you do need to do that to a certain point just for work-life balance and one's own mental well-being. Otherwise, you'll go through the same story again and again. But, you know, it is, you're putting out a product, and so I think having pride and sort of exhorting others to have pride, and not just go through the motions, is, you know, something, so long as we don't take it personally, we should all think about.
So having been in the media, as you have for the last 3 years, yeah, or more, I should say, do you think we're well served, me as a consumer, people listening to us as media consumers, are well served by the media we have in this market, at least?
I think so. I mean, it could be better. I think that's the case in a lot of places. You know, we don't have a four-newspaper war like Toronto and scores of alternative publications, but that's partly a case of population. There is only about 2.5 million people in our semicircle, and because we're right on the border, it's not like there's cross-pollination going on there. So you do only have a business model, regardless of what year it is, for so many publications. But I think, you know, they're good journalists. You don't get to be in Vancouver unless you're good at your job. And, you know, when you look at the stuff that is produced in this day and age that you get to see, where so many stories, both for newspapers and TV stations, have integrated video, there's deep analysis, there's embedded multimedia, you're getting a mix of breaking stories quicker than you ever have before, and you're getting interesting deep features. You have a great Globe and Mail bureau here, which is the best outside Toronto by far. There's a lot to like.
So you said that it could be better, and I'm curious to know where it could be better. Do you think it's in newsrooms reflecting, say, the diversity of the community? Is it in the proprietors themselves and investing resources so that there are outlets?
There's that. There can always be that. There's the fact that, unfortunately, the Vancouver Sun and the Province have, like all post-media papers, been forced to do a massive amount of cost-cutting the last 5 years. But for a variety of reasons, their cuts, for the most part, have been deeper. There's the fact that it's just very difficult to be a freelance journalist in Vancouver compared to Toronto, both because of the cost of living here and the amount of publications. And so, therefore, you don't have quite as many young, bubbling up people and pieces that necessarily you would want in a city of this size. So there's there's a few things where if you suddenly went, if I was a god of journalism and the land, you would make a little bit better. But it also is the business in 2015, and there's good journalists, but you shrug your shoulders sometimes that, you know, there's some things about the model right now that are just inflexible given the geography and financial position of some of the larger organizations.
What about the media consumer, the citizen? I mean, what role do they have to play? I get annoyed sometimes when I hear newspaper proprietors, for example, complain that me, as a news reader, haven't done enough. We see the product, say the Vancouver Sun, that's declined just in content and the number of pages and the sort over the years. And as a result, the newspaper jacks up the price.
Mm-hmm.
Have we as media consumers done enough? I mean, we started the conversation about the feedback you get from your viewers.
Mm-hmm.
What role do we have to play in all of this?
I'm not sure. I try not to think of putting any demands on the reader. That's like putting demands on the human condition, I tend to think. I think generally, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think you can always say you can complain what readers do or where readers go. I mean, you know, lots of journalists rant to me, and I rant about them about Van City Buzz, which is the main online news source for a lot of young people in this city. But what I've come to say more and more is, hey, they're filling a gap, and they're filling a niche that young people think aren't being met, and there's always lessons to be learned by that. So I tend to think that, you know, I use the reader is never wrong. When they yell at me themselves and think that they're wrong, I tend to back away from that for a second. But I think, you know, holistically, when you're looking from it from a sort of big picture management view, there's not a whole lot to be gained from that conversation.
So journalism has changed just in the short time you've been a part of it, been in the business.
So much.
Yeah. So 5 years down the road, I mean, will the modes by which we receive news, will that change a whole hell of a lot?
Oh, to a point. I mean, we're starting to get at the point where everyone has a smartphone, everyone is plugged in, and sort of the constant technology fetish of the last 10-15 years is subsiding. You know, I often think of a great quote that Alf Hermida, a UBC journalism professor, said that, you know, television got good once people took it for granted, where it wasn't about the technology anymore, and when people weren't transposing over essentially radio plays, but when it just was something that was there that people were comfortable with, and it was exploring in those mediums. So at this point, I think everyone knows how a story goes viral and why. They know the trade-off between what is good and well-researched and what is a toss-off but gets lots of hits, and how to balance those things. We know all how to put video in and why it's important. We know the value still of breaking news versus a long feature. It's just figuring out that right mix, and it's figuring out, more importantly, a business model that sustains it. But I always say those decisions are made by someone higher up in my pay grade. But I think for, you know, any journalist worth their salt, if they focus on stories that they enjoy doing, that they know information, and that they're fine packaging in the way that essentially people are willing to pay for in whatever year it is, they'll be fine.
You mentioned the criticism that you've had for Van City Buzz and websites of the sort. I mean, it must frustrate you that the people our age rely on websites like that, and Van City Buzz in particular, mm-hmm. as their news source.
I am, but I'm a cranky old man generally. I always say that I'm 28 going on 80 or whatever age I happen to be at the year I say that. You know, younger people, there's always a market in any city, in any year that you've been in, for sort of the yellow journalism, the tabloid, the lowest common denominator, the thing that just rips the headline, tells you the basic stuff, might get the facts right, might get it wrong, but it's just done in the entertaining way that people appeal to at the time. And that's Van City Buzz in this market, for better or worse, and so I tend to say, you know, I like to remind my friends on Facebook what they do, and you know, the work obviously that I do, and the due diligence that I do every day, of which I'm proud. But I think you can lose too much sleep in any market if you care about the people that aren't doing journalism the way that you might like to see it done, because there's always going to be people like that. All you can really do is focus on your stuff and hope it's good, and shrug your shoulders at the rest.
So ideally, you'd like us to watch the TV news, you'd like us to listen to the radio, you'd like us to get a newspaper subscription.
That would be very good for my career, and I think, you know, but I think for the most part, people would be well-informed. I also think that they should read blogs, and they should find people that they disagree with vociferously politically and listen to them so they can understand those points of view better, and read, you know, media sources that are biased one way or biased another. I think you grow your mind with the more sources that you do ultimately read, and you better yourself as a citizen.
Yeah,
but you should watch Global.
I think a lot of us have grown up with Global.
Yeah.
I mean, do you notice that?
I grew up with Global.
Yeah.
I've watched Squire Barnes and Keith Baldry and Tony Parsons and Deb Hope and the like when I was on Vancouver Island. And that's a neat thing to be a part of. And it's a neat thing for a lot of people in our newsroom. And, you know, I know our management that we now have with Jill Kropp and the rest, they're great people. They know that tradition, and they know of the opportunity that we have to continue telling stories and continue to really matter to the vast majority of British Columbians.
Now, someone from Van City Buzz, I've never talked to anybody from there, but just to play devil's advocate, would say that the reason why they're so successful is that they're better representing, say, the community, their audience, than,
yes,
say, the legacy traditional media, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it. Are those discussions that media outlets, not just at Global, but say CTV, CBC, the newspapers that we've mentioned already, do you think that's something that they're thinking about in terms of say, reflecting the community, reflecting its audience?
I think so. I mean, you're always trying to figure out how young people are consuming news in different ways. You're always trying to see, okay, here's the new development and how stories are told. Are we following it? If not, is there a good reason, and not just that we haven't been paying attention, because, or is it part of a philosophical thing? So it's interesting, because it's the same thing that happens with all companies when technology disrupts and it breaks up old established ways of doing things. And it was certainly the case for newspapers over the last decade. And unfortunately, they, for a variety of reasons, the vast majority of them were either caught flat-footed or simply had too many costs or had ownership that couldn't invest in the proper ways. And so the state of newspapers is greatly weakened from what it is 10 years ago. In terms of TV, you know, we're in a much better position, and I think we can learn a lot from what's happened in the past. And so, you know, everyone at Global looks at what's happening out there online and how people consume stories and the way that they want it, and how we can be there and do better without losing sight of the things that make us good in the first place.
The problem is, though, if you all did the news that say the audience wanted, mm-hmm. You'd have YouTube videos of stuff exploding and cats.
And you know, for decades, Global and BCTV has distinguished itself by going deeper into stories, going longer, having more extensive coverage, getting out there into the province where other places aren't going, and that's always served us well. As well, so it's always the tricky thing. And I remember when I was at the province newspaper, I would wonder, you know, sometimes how come there's like 8 or 9 media organizations in this city? How can we make it so our story on the thing of the day stands out and is unique? And, you know, I think at Global we do that. I certainly hope we do. But I know that that's something that, you know, you should always be striving for.
Now, the other thing that you're known for online is your keen interest in history. Mm-hmm. You do the quizzes, I guess, on the Global website, right?
Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of, I try and figure out a lot of geography and history type things because... they're fun for me, and a lot of people seem to like them, which is pretty cool.
Some of them are kind of tough, though.
A lot of them are kind of tough. And I always have to remind myself of that. But I think it's, you know, we are the voice for British Columbia in the media in a lot of ways. And so I think anytime that, you know, you can try and do quizzes where there's a story about something that's well known in Prince Rupert and something that's well known in Nelson and Victoria, we're doing our job sort of as a brand and as a voice, whether someone knows all those questions and is frustrated at the quiz or my name at the end of it is something that I laugh about, but I can't concern.
Do you find that people in your cohort and your age group are largely ignorant or illiterate with regards to history, especially of this place?
It's a good question, and I tend to think a little bit, if only because I do care so much. You know, I know in BC, when you're in grade 4 and 5 and 6, you learn about Barkerville and you learn about the fur trade and Confederation, and then BC history just sort of stops.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pick it up at Expo 86. And, you know, I do think that's a shame. We are such a unique province, both in terms of how we were founded, our geography, just the wide range of cities in the north and south, big and small, that have impacted this place in different cultural ways. And... But I go back to whether people do or not, or whether I'm personally concerned or not. I go, well, it's interesting to me, so I'll put it out there. And if you get enough people going, huh, I never knew that, or that was cool, then I consider that sort of just, you know, a day-to-day success.
Now you on your website, ranked all the heritage minutes from Historica Canada.
All 80 or so, 17,000 words that I will never get back, but it was a great fun and sort of personal highlight, I guess would be a word, of something I've been able to do.
It's marvelous insight, and in your opinion, obviously, is just wonderful to read. I didn't realize how many there were,
and
how many I've seen.
Because you remember the 5 or 6 that are interesting to you, and then the rest glaze over like any commercial. But that was a fun discovery for me as well, is just how many I'd completely forgotten about, and then deciding whether that was because they were unremarkable or just ones that had passed me by, and then seeing them with fresh eyes 15 years later.
Well, what surprised you in terms of what people remember?
I think it is the fact that sort of, and the Heritage Men and people might not like this, but the ones that are always remembered are a little bit, and the ones that I got the feedback for, the ones where it's a little bit hokey, a little bit contrived, a one that's sort of an over-the-top one-minute performance piece, because I think that's also the way that it sticks out and you remember something, especially when you're a kid.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the ones where it's Wilford Penefield and seizures and someone's shouting out, "I smell burnt toast."
Yeah.
It's an old man standing on top of a ladder next to James Naismith saying, "But I need these baskets back." It's this young child explaining why she's named a bear Winnie the Pooh by just saying, "I don't know."
Yeah.
Where it just, you know, you create all this artifice to making this moment that stands out in your, again, I think it should always be meant for young people, a moment that they'll stick with and sort of have a better sense of what we've done as a country and who we are.
We're talking on Thursday morning where a couple of days ago, I guess the latest one has come out on,
yes,
Terry Fox.
And it's really hilarious to me because a couple weeks ago, the Historica Canada put out a call for people to essentially propose filming new Heritage Minutes. And I know this because three or four people sent me the link, mm-hmm, because this is what happens when you write way too much.
This is what people know you for
better or worse. And now, of course, you know, the application is more on the technical side, and can you helm a studio to produce a commercial, which for me is not really. But I said to people when we were chatting about it, without knowing this one, that, you know, the Heritage Minute that needs to be done is Terry Fox, because he's a Canadian hero. It's a story that is remarkable. It's a story that can be condensed. It's a story about a British Columbian, and before this, only one Heritage Minute had been done explicitly about a British Columbian. That's Emily Carr, which is fairly shocking when you think about it. And it's a story that is new. History progresses, and our sense of ourselves and our heritage continues, and it's not all stuck in a 1700 to 1945 time frame. It goes, and stories that have happened in the last 30, 40 years are going to define how we think about our sense of being moving forward. And so I said, you know, Terry Fox, that's the perfect one. If they don't do the next one as Terry Fox, I'll write a big rant on my website. I literally said that. I'll write a big rant on my website just for fun. And lo and behold, it came out. So that was cool to see, and hopefully people will get a kick out of it.
Where does it rank?
Oh, I think you, like all history, you have to wait, right? But I mean, for myself, it was very well done. It was very serious and sort of had a grittiness that they do for a lot of their the war Heritage Minutes, remarkably enough. And I tend to not like those as much stylistically. But I think, you know, just the story itself is one that's so good and so perfect for Canada. A few of my friends have remarked that it's sort of explaining Terry Fox to non-Canadians and why he's important always gets a little bit of a raised eyebrow.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense to us, and it's part of it is that you had to be there, and part of it is it defines our spirit. But the story of a guy who had cancer and tried to run across the country but failed, and now he's beloved for decades, is one that is uniquely Canadian. And so I would, you know, you say high points on that, medium points on the stylistic, probably around 30th all time out of 80,
yeah.
But we'll see. Eventually I'll have to write an appendix.
What do you think should be done next, say?
It's a good question. I think
something, say, in the 70s on, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could do something. It's difficult to do political ones when people are still alive, because you do then tend to get into controversy and, you know, rewriting history. But, you know, the October crisis would definitely be one that would be interesting. One on Tommy Douglas, certainly, would as well. I think there's a lot that, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that could be there. But it's just up for people to shout and say, this matters and we need to talk about it.
How often do they do these? Well, once a year now?
Now it's about once every 6 months, which
really?
Is nice.
Oh,
because there was that, like, you know, 7-8 year-long gap where just nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that at that clip, then it regenerates it and it keeps it fresh in people's minds, and is doable even if there isn't a giant funding push behind it.
And you were able to find all of them on YouTube.
Yeah. It was one of those things where it literally was my brain going, we were talking about it in a bar, and I went, hey, no one's ever ranked these things. And then I went home and found that Historica had posted them all
yeah.
on YouTube. And then it was just many hours of just watching them on loop, and something I advise no one to ever do.
So having seen all of them, they are historically accurate. We're not being hoodwinked, are we?
Also, I mean, this is part of the funny thing. In some of them, you know, there is nip. Are not 100% historically accurate. And I would have to, and I pointed them out in the minutes, in the write-ups themselves, you know,
yeah.
the Halifax explosion one, which is a famous one. It wasn't quite as immediate of the warning, and the trains weren't quite as close away, for example. The Winnie the Pooh one, which I care about way too much just because I love Winnie the Pooh. There's A. Milman, Mr. Shepherd, together in this park, and a shepherd did not care for AML whatsoever. He would never be in a park with his daughter. And there's a few little things like that come in, but of course you're trying to tell a story in 1 minute time and trying to make it dramatic and trying to give it a narrative arc. So, you know, there's none that I saw where it's just gratuitously wrong. But it is, you know, I think part of the charm of how sometimes it's like, well, actually, no.
Yeah, and it's funny how they have, for a lot of people, been the only encounter with, say, that historical moment that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate, but I mean, that's reality, isn't it?
It's reality, and I think that, you know, most people, it's hard to get people to care about the past, and whether it's harder now in today's age, I don't know, because I've only been alive 28 years, but, you know, any time, I use the word trek often, and not in a negative way, but, you know, in the context of when you can get people interested in a subject through the lens of whatever, in this case, you know, sort of a hokey, 1 minute, over-the-top, contrived historical scene, and they come away with an appreciation of that, I think, you know, you've done your job, and sometimes that's the way to do it. In the same way that, you know, sometimes I'll do listicles, that are very policy-based and very data-heavy, but they're getting much more read and much more shared simply because they are in a listicle format.
Yeah. In terms of journalism and journalists that you have come to admire, that you view as influences, I mean, are there particular people that you can name?
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, there were, you know, a few writers, you know, Paul Wells, Andrew Coyne, Tom Hawthorne, a few others that I read quite a bit. I enjoyed reading Alan Fotheringham's writings. I enjoyed, you know, in a more contemporary, Bill Simmons for sports writing and
mm-hmm.
Joe Posansky. And, you know, I think like any writer in terms of your voice, at first you completely copy and then things graph together and your own voice comes in it. And then eventually you have your own unique thing. You know, in terms of present day people, you know, there's it's cool to be able to work with and be colleagues with people that I either watched growing up, like Keith Baldry, or people that were mentors to me in university, like John Woodward, a CTV reporter, who's another UBC alumnus. And you know, there's a lot of good people out there. I mean, I could talk forever about interesting journalists and people that I admire in the field, but I will say it's tremendously fun to be part of that sometimes in a tiny little way.
Well, was there a moment for you in these last few years that you thought, when it happened, that you made the right choice in going into journalism?
Oh, I never not... I tried never not to think of that, but... I mean, one of them... I'll tell you what was one. It was the 2013 provincial election. I was fortunate enough that they trusted me with helping run the decision desk on that night with deciding all of the writings.
Yeah.
And so working on that, talking with, you know, the producers in terms of when things are called, liaising with Keith Baldry. You know, at the end of the night, we called all 79 writings correctly. 85 writings correctly, right. I should say now. But at the end of the night, and this is at like midnight now, me and about four or five other people that I'd all worked with in the previous year at the UBC student newspaper, we met up and we had all worked that night for different places in the city, whether it was Vancouver Courier, CTV, the Globe and Mail, 24 Hours, and we all just got to share our stories and look around and say, hey, look at us, just a year out of university, we're doing this, we're having some sort of small impact, and we're all really enjoying this at a high moment. And so that was something that was very cool and sticks with me.
And so when you talk to younger people, mm-hmm. Are you evangelical, say, in telling them about journalism as a field to pursue?
I'm both evangelical and I'm realistic. You know, I tell people, look, the jobs that you might have fantasized about 10 years ago rarely exist anymore. You will likely have to freelance for a while. You will likely have to move to a small town that you do not want to move to. Like any profession, you will have a job that you think probably is beneath you, and then you will go to a slightly better thing, and then a slightly better thing, and none of them will be that shining star on the hill that you imagined. And be aware of that going in. Know the expectations, but also know that it is a heck of a lot of fun, and every day is different, and if you can do it well, then you're inclined that there's nothing else that you'll prefer doing in the world.
You view it as a service?
Absolutely. I think, yes, there's the business aspect of it, mm-hmm. Otherwise we all wouldn't get paid, but I think you have to do it as you're providing something,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you're trying to, whatever it is that for you it is, whether it's raising the discourse, whether it's providing specific information on a beat, whether it's entertaining people, you know, you're putting, like I said earlier, you're putting that thing out there for everyone in a non-discriminatory fashion every day, and I think that's, you have to have that viewpoint to do it well.
Justin, this has been great fun for me because, as I said, I'm a great admirer of your work. Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks very much. You're far too kind with your praise, I've had a blast.
The website for more, justinmcelroy.com, and of course, as he said earlier, we must watch a Global with great regularity. Justin McElroy joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.